I'm not sure how long my voice is going to last this evening. Some of you have heard me tell this before about the preacher who used to take a cough drop and he put it in his mouth and he knew how long, generally speaking, it would take for him to just eliminate it, and that's how he judged the length of his sermon. Only one time, instead of getting a cough drop, he got a button. And he just kept preaching and preaching and preaching because it didn't dissolve. So, if somebody needs to check on my cough drop later on, you'll know what happened. The Battle of the Bulge was one of the largest, arguably the largest and bloodiest battles of the Second World War. It was the result of a massive German counteroffensive in mid-December 1944. The Allies had been pushing across Europe, and Germany was attempting to push back in the areas of Luxembourg and Belgium. And the Allies, quite frankly, were taken by surprise. And for a variety of reasons, they didn't expect this particular attack by the Germans, and so the Allied forces were pushed back, which created a bulge in their defensive line. And hence the expression, the Battle of the Bulge. You see here the original line here, and then the Germans push this way, and the line eventually goes all the way back to here. The Germans are in here. There's also a city here, and I believe it's pronounced Bastogne. And the Allied forces there were actually surrounded by these German units that covered 60 miles in 2 days. They were chewing up territory, and they surrounded the city of Bastogne and cut it off. And the situation looked pretty bleak, especially for the Allied forces that were in that city and, for that matter, this whole defensive area. However, when the German commander demanded the Allied surrender at Bastogne, the Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe refused and responded with a single blunt word. And it inspired his troops. The Allies in Bastogne held on until they could be resupplied by air at first, and then later Patton pushed through with an armored division, and help could push through the German lines. Individual battles are not unimportant, but the success of the war in general is the main issue. Am I not on? I'm on? Okay. The Germans advanced, as I said, 60 miles in 2 days. But their whole offensive, or counteroffensive, fizzled because they ran out of fuel. They were short on fuel, and they had been counting on being able to capture fuel that hadn't been destroyed by the Allies. And so that would be how they would continue their armored attack. When the weather cleared, Allied air power, which was superior to the German Air Force at this time, was able again to control the air, and so the Allies recovered. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this is that we are in a struggle ourselves. We're in a struggle against evil. The Bible doesn't talk about Satan as a mythical character. The Bible talks about Satan as a real being. And I appreciated the songs that Tim selected because they portray us exactly as the Scriptures do. We're soldiers. We're combatants in this struggle against evil. And as we do that, as we struggle against Satan and against those who would do his bidding, there are times when we're going to suffer temporary defeat. There are times when we suffer spiritual setbacks. And it's easy for us to, as the Allies were in the Battle of the Bulge, to be pushed back so that we begin to wonder if we're even going to be able to win this conflict. Well, this evening what I want to do is talk a little bit about the fact that Satan can be defeated. The devil can be beaten. And I want to talk to you, first of all, about the history of this struggle against Satan. From the very beginning of mankind, Satan won. When we look at Adam and Eve in the garden, God had given them very few restrictions, apparently. They were not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the midst of the garden, and yet we understand from Genesis 3 that that's exactly what they did. And as a result, they were punished. They were excluded from the garden. And in fact, we all die spiritually, physically, as a result of the curse that was placed on Adam and Eve at that point. And so, in the very beginning, there was an initial defeat. Adam and Eve fell prey to Satan. In Genesis 4, the very next chapter, we read about Cain and his murder of his brother Abel. Once again, Satan is the victor in this matter of morality. And as we go through the Old Testament, we see again and again that mankind is being defeated. In the lives of the patriarchs, such stellar individuals as Abraham, a man of faith, and yet, in Genesis 12, he lacks the faith to trust God, and so he lies to Pharaoh about his wife Sarah being his sister. She was his half-sister, and he lies about that so that he can be protected. He should have trusted in God. And his son Isaac did the very same thing in Genesis 26 with respect to Abimelech, king of Gerar. The sons of Jacob in Genesis 37, moved by hatred and envy, sold their own brother into slavery. Two of the sons, Simeon and Levi, slaughtered all the men of Shechem for the purpose of revenge. And what we see as we go through the history of mankind is that Satan is just racking up victory after victory in the lives of these individuals. But his dominance continues all the way through the Old Testament. Even King David, who was described by God as a man after his own heart, in 2 Samuel 11, committed the horrendous sins of adultery first and then the murder of the husband of the woman that he had taken in adultery. Bathsheba becomes his wife, but David's going to suffer for the rest of his life because of the consequences that God placed upon him. And then there's Solomon. Solomon, who built the temple, who had the privilege of building a house, a physical house for God, and one of the wisest, if not the wisest man to live. And yet, 1 Kings 11 tells us that because of the influence of his wives, he fell into idolatry. And so even in the lives of all of these impressive individuals, and I suspect perhaps exception of Cain, all these are individuals of some renown, Satan wins in every case. Mankind is being defeated by Satan. Paul summarizes the situation with mankind in Romans, the third chapter, verses 22 and 23, when he says, "Even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ to all and on all who believe, for there is no difference." He's talking about Jew and Gentile. "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." Nobody was winning against Satan. Everybody was losing. In the fifth chapter of Romans, and in verse 12, Paul says, "Therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sinned." So when we talk about this struggle against Satan, Paul's conclusion is that all men are failing. All men are losing in this warfare against the adversary, against the tempter. But what we see in the Old Testament in particular is that God had a plan. He had a strategy for victory. And we see that strategy, the divine preparations for this victory over Satan, in some key Old Testament promises. And these are very familiar promises, so if you'll permit me, I'm not going to spend a lot of time reading them or discussing them. I think just to mention the promise probably will suffice. In Genesis, the third chapter, in verse 15, as God is talking to Adam and Eve and to the serpent. To the serpent, he says that the woman's seed, there would be enmity between him and the woman's seed, and the woman's seed would bruise his head, even as the serpent bruised the heel of the woman's seed. Now, when we go over into the book of Galatians, chapter 3, we find out that seed was Christ. And so we understand that even in the beginning of the history of mankind, that God already had a plan whereby Satan was going to be defeated. And that plan begins to see even greater light. We see greater light in Genesis, the 12th chapter, where God makes the promise to Abraham that out of his descendants there would be a seed through whom all the families of the earth would be blessed. When we go to Acts, the third chapter, we find from the mouth of the Apostle Peter that the blessing that God anticipated in this promise was the forgiveness of sins and turning us from our sins. And so God's plan is continuing apace. In 2 Samuel 7, there's a promise made to David. David wanted to build the temple in Jerusalem. He wasn't permitted to do so. That would be Solomon. But God said, I'm going to build you a house, speaking of a genealogy of descendants, and that David's seed, David's son, would sit on his throne and would establish a kingdom that would never, that would last forever. And of course, we understand that Jesus is the son of David. He's the seed of David that sits on David's throne, and he rules over all those who enthrone them in his heart. And so the promise becomes a little bit more specific. Now we know it's not just a woman's seed. We know specifically it's the lineage of David. And we know that he's going to be a king. He's going to rule. His authority will not end. Isaiah chapter 53 is an important promise because it tells us that God intends for one to die on behalf of mankind. I would like to read this passage, beginning in verse 4 of Isaiah 53. If you want to follow along in your Old Testaments, that's Isaiah 53 and beginning in verse 4. The prophet wrote, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed." So there in verses 5 through, verse 5 in particular, we're told that the suffering of Jesus Christ was on our behalf. It was because of us. "All we like sheep have gone astray," verse 6 says. "We've turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted. Yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter. And as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment. And who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgressions of my people he was stricken. And they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death. Because he'd done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When you make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant shall justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities." And so the picture here in Isaiah 53 is that there's someone coming, and God's going to lay the transgressions, the penalty for the transgressions of all mankind on that individual. He's going to bear them. He's going to suffer because of their sins. And God's going to see his suffering, and God's going to allow many to be justified. That's a promise. And we know, of course, that Jesus fulfilled that promise, even though the Jews apparently did not understand that was the nature of the Messiah, that he would be a suffering Messiah. In Hebrews, the 8th chapter, this passage in Jeremiah 31 is quoted. It is a passage in which Jeremiah notes that in the future, God's going to establish a new covenant. And it'll be different in some ways from the covenant that he had established with his people through Moses. It'll be a covenant in which forgiveness will actually be available. Iniquities will be remembered no more. And so what I want you to see is that even as mankind is taking defeat after defeat in their individual lives, as they give in to sin and Satan essentially then owns them, still God has this strategy, this plan, this redemptive plan that he's working from the beginning of mankind, although the plan existed even before then, all the way through the Old Testament. And when we come to the New Testament, what we find is that Jesus becomes the captain of our salvation. He's the only man who does battle with Satan, tempted in all points, like as we, Hebrews 4:15, and yet without sin. He's the only one who was never defeated by Satan. And so in that way, he becomes the author or the captain of our salvation. In Hebrews, the 2nd chapter, and in verse 10, The Hebrew writer says, "For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings." In the end of chapter 6 and verse 20, the Hebrew writer talks about how Jesus is the forerunner. He's the one who goes before into the most holy place. What, of course, he was doing in the redemptive work that he performed on the cross was he was opening the means or opening the path for us to follow and to be able to come into the presence of God, into heaven itself. And so in that sense, he's the forerunner who has entered into the most holy place, having become a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. In Hebrews, the 12th chapter, in verse 2, he is again referred to as the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So, we've got this plan that God has laid out, and Jesus is the one who's leading the way to victory for us. Now, what the Bible tells us is that Satan ultimately is going to be defeated. In fact, the stage has already been set through the work that Jesus did on the cross. In Hebrews, the 2nd chapter, in verse 14, in chapter 2, the Hebrews writer is answering the question, if Jesus is superior to the angels, which was his point in chapter 1, then why do we see Jesus as a man in flesh and blood lower than the angels? And the answer is, he doesn't give aid to angels. He was designed to give aid to men. And so, inasmuch as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil. And so what the Hebrew writer says is that through the death of Jesus Christ, through his redemptive death on the cross, essentially, he destroyed Satan. Satan's the one who has the power of death. As he tempts individuals and they sin, the penalty for that is death. And so he's the one who's kept men under bondage for fear of death all their lives, as the text will say a little bit later. But the stage has been set for Satan's defeat. In fact, there's a rather interesting passage, and that is an incorrect reference. It should be 12, 10, and 11. There's a beginning in verse 7 of chapter 12 there in Revelation, there is what I think is probably a symbolic battle there. I don't know that this was a literal battle between Michael and his angels and the devil and his angels, but the result of that is that Satan has been cast out of heaven. But I want you to notice the consequence here, beginning in verse 10. John said, "I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night," who is that? Well, in chapter 12, it's the dragon, it's Satan. He has been cast down, we were told that back in verses 7 through 9. "And they overcame him," that is the brethren, "by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death." That is a victory statement. What John hears is someone saying, they beat Satan. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. When Jesus became the captain of our salvation, in his death, he provided the means for us likewise to be victorious. Not because we successfully resist sin every time as he did, but because we have access to divine favor in the matter of forgiveness. And so in that way, we overcame Satan by the blood of the Lamb. That is, we can, as it is applied to us and forgives our sins. Now, what that means is that Satan is going to be defeated. But the fact of the matter is, we're still going to lose some battles. But what the text says, what the New Testament teaches us, is that the war is ours to win. You remember I said that individual battles are not unimportant, but the real issue, the primary issue, is who wins the war. We're going to lose some battles. All of us sin from time to time because of our own weakness or our own ignorance. we end up sinning and we lose that battle with Satan. We give in to temptation as he uses temptation to appeal to our own desires, our fleshly desires. But the real issue is, do you win the war? Not do you lose or win all battles. However, I want you to notice some passages. James chapter 4 and verse 7 says, therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. And now the passage that Daniel read for us prior to our study, beginning of our study, here in verse 8 of 1 Peter 5, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, this is a warfare that we're involved in, and the stake is your soul and my soul, the souls of men. The stake is our eternal destiny. And the question is, what will happen to us at the day of judgment? Your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith. So we're told how it is that we can resist him, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. So we can win these battles. We'll not win all of them, but the means for winning them is provided for us. And that's what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians the 10th chapter and verse 13. You know, it took me a long time to get through my head that this is a passage that's addressed to Christians. And I'm not sure that that promise applies to non-Christians. I believe that's one of the spiritual blessings that Paul talks about in Ephesians 1:3 that are in Christ Jesus. Spiritual blessings that are provided for Christians. Here's the blessing. It doesn't make any difference what temptation comes against you. God, with the temptation, will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. In a battle sometimes, we may not, if it's a physical contest, we may not understand how it is that we can win that contest. We may not understand the way to beat our adversary. But listen to me, every time we fight against Satan, the way of escape is always there. That's the promise. God says you can defeat him, steadfast in the faith. You need to resist him. God is faithful. He is dependable, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. You sometimes feel like you're assaulted by temptations that you just can't beat. What does that passage say? I believe that passage is saying that you can beat the temptations that you face. God doesn't allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able to bear. Satan is still active, but the fact of the matter is, his hands are partially tied in this whole battle. God has given you and he's given me the promise that we can win every battle that we choose to win. Well, what have we learned in all of this in talking about the battle against Satan? Well, remember what we said in the beginning, that when we look back over the history of mankind, Satan just won and won and won. In fact, it really wasn't until God made available his grace through the forgiveness of sins that we can win the battle. I can't win by myself. If you and I try to beat Satan by ourselves, we're not going to win. We need God's help in order to do that. It is said that the entire text of a speech one time by Winston Churchill, he was asked to give a speech to a graduating class, I believe, of a school. And many of you are aware that Winston Churchill was an individual who had a way with words. Here's the text of his speech. I'm going to read all of it to you. He got up and he said, never, never, never give in. And then he sat down. Don't ever quit. Don't ever surrender. The Allied forces, as we talked about a little bit earlier, in the desperate battle of the Bulge, were pushed back. They were being defeated. The Germans were really in control of the day. But the Allies didn't give up. And eventually the battle was won. And as you know, the war was won. And that's really the issue. We need to be careful that we don't become discouraged by the sins with which we struggle. There are going to be temporary setbacks, and I'm not excusing sin. I'm not saying it's insignificant. I'm not saying that we ought not to worry about those times when we do fall short of the glory of God, but I'll tell you what. We don't serve ourselves. It doesn't benefit us, I should say, for us to be discouraged and to beat ourselves up because we have failed in our contest with Satan on a particular occasion. What we need to do is dust ourselves off and understand that we can win the war. In fact, Satan has already been defeated. His ultimate defeat is a certainty. We didn't talk about this, but I believe you could go to Revelation 20. And I believe Revelation 20 does picture what's going to happen to Satan at the end of time. That he's going to be consigned to the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, even as Jesus said in Matthew 25 when he said to the goats, "Depart from me." You know, you're going to be consigned to the lake of fire that was prepared for the devil and his angels. And that's the picture that you see in Revelation chapter 20. Satan's ultimate defeat is a certainty. And we can defeat him in our individual lives through the forgiveness that's available in Jesus Christ. Not because we're so strong, but because we can team up with God and God enables us and God forgives us. Now, if you're not a Christian, you're fighting all by yourself. That's the truth of the matter. Divine grace is available to those who obey the gospel. In Hebrews, the 5th chapter, in verse 9, the comment is made with respect to Jesus that having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all those who obey him. He was perfected through his obedience to the Father, and he becomes the author of eternal salvation to those who likewise obey the will of the Father, who obey the gospel. But if you don't obey the gospel, if you're not a Christian, then basically you're fighting Satan on your own and by yourself and without the assistance of God. But in the gospel, in the good news of salvation, there's grace, there's forgiveness, there's hope and peace. And we want to encourage you to take advantage of that in this battle that all of us have to fight. If you need to obey the gospel this evening, or if you're a Christian who has been defeated and you've gotten discouraged, and you need the brethren to pray for you, then we want to encourage you likewise. We'll assist you. We'll pray with you. We want to encourage you. If you have a need, we encourage you to come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you.